The show's live and local. It's your connection to local music and more. We've got a lot of baseball music in the first half of our show today for the Baseball Music Project, which is the name of a show that's going to be at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts in Urbana tomorrow night at 7:30, although preliminaries start late in the afternoon. You can meet some of the University of Illinois baseball players, and there's a lecture on the physics of baseball. There's free popcorn and book sales and other kinds of things going on. But the Baseball Music Project is the big thing at 7:30. It'll feature host and narrator Dave Winfield, a great Hall of Famer. And on our show today, we have the conductor for the proceedings, Bob Thompson. He'll be leading the Champaign-Urbana Symphony Orchestra in that concert. Later on in the program, we'll have Henson Keyes from the University of Illinois Theater Department, who is the stage director for the U of I Opera Program's production of Verdi's famous opera Rigoletto, which opens tonight at the Krannert Center and continues through Sunday. Should be an action-packed show. Hope you'll stay with us. Was one of the better-known baseball songs, Joltin' Joe DiMaggio, and we're going to hear maybe some of the lesser-known songs, or at least one of them that I've never heard before, so I'm looking forward to in a little bit. And the reason we're playing baseball music for this half hour on Live and Local is because we've got the Baseball Music Project coming to the Krannert Center tomorrow night, and we have with us the conductor of the show, who's going to join us in a matter of seconds. Our broadcast today on FM 90.9 is made possible with support from the Craft League of Champaign-Urbana, presenting their 28th annual Arts and Craft Show on November 13th and 14th at the Urbana Civic Center, open Saturday 10 to 5 and Sunday 10 to 4. More information is available at 367-9546. And I'm flipping through my pages here. I've got somewhere some information on our conductor. Here we go. Robert Thompson, or Bob Thompson, as he's generally billed, is a music director, founder, and producer of the Baseball Music Project. And he was apparently destined for involvement in this because he was born in the town where Babe Ruth now resides, so to speak, in Hawthorne, New York. And he says here, his claim to fame is that he played trumpet at George Steinbrenner's daughter's wedding and got all of $200 for it. He's pretty well known as a cheapskate, isn't he?
Well, I blew those $200 on Yankees tickets, so he got the money back.
Yeah. I'm sure he appreciated that. You also are co-author of a book called Baseball's Greatest Hit, The Story of Take Me Out to the Ball Game, which is the one song we're not going to play today. People can probably sing that in their head right now. Co-authoring another book with former New York Yankee Bernie Williams called Rhythms of the Game, coming out next year. Is all going well for that? It'll be out next year?
It's going great. Paul Simon's writing the foreword, and it's a wonderful book that explores the parallel mindsets of ballplayers and musicians.
And musicians, yeah. Well, there's a lot of fans, certainly among musicians, of baseball. You've also been a professor of music, University of Kentucky, Hope College in Michigan. I taught trumpet and jazz studies, and also former dean of music at the State University of New York at Purchase College. When I read all those things, I was expecting to see, you know, some old gray-haired guy, and here you got this long blondish hair, and, you know, I don't know, but that's more the image of the long-haired conductor. So has that grown since your academic days?
No, it started like in the 80s. I was working on my doctorate, but they still gave me tenure in spite of the long hair. So
yeah, well, your students probably loved you for that. Although, you know, I remember having John Morrell, who was one of our favorite professors of philosophy at Northwestern, and he had long hair and a ponytail and was really cool. And he didn't get tenure. Everybody was very upset. Not related to this conversation, obviously. You like to call yourself the world's foremost baseball musicologist in spite of the fact that there's no such thing as baseball musicology, according to the American Musicological Association.
That's true, but there's not much competition for that title, so... You know, I thought I'd claim the mantle.
So this has been going on since, what, 2006?
Yeah, 2006. The genesis for the idea, however, was I was actually living in Europe, in Vienna, and I was getting very homesick for the sport. There's no baseball in Vienna, in case your listeners don't know that.
I didn't know that.
There is no baseball. There's lots of soccer. And I was listening to an Armed Forces radio broadcast of a Yankees game, and the announcer, radio announcer John Sterling, was—I think Roger Clemens was pitching—and he mentioned that Clemens had thrown the batter a little chin music, and I didn't know what chin music was, and I looked it up online. I typed in chin music baseball. Lo and behold, I come across this link to the Baseball Hall of Fame. That they had acquired this collection of music about baseball. It was over 400 songs. And I thought, wait a minute, there's only one song about baseball. Take me out to the ballgame. Well, it turns out that there are over 1,000 songs going back to 1858.
According to your website, over 1,200 songs.
Well, actually, it's closer to 3,000.
Really?
In fact, in 1 3-month period back in 1956, the Pacific Coast League Hollywood Stars sponsored a songwriting competition, and they got over 3,000 entries, including the largest piece of music ever written about baseball. It was 6 feet high and 4 feet wide. So there you go.
And what was that song?
I don't know what the song is, but it hasn't...
It hasn't come down to posterity, huh?
Yeah. Very few have, actually. Of those 3,000-plus songs written about the sport, you know, 98% of them are not all that great. But there are 50 or 60 gems.
We have with us the very first known baseball tune. Is it actually a song, though?
It's a song, and this is the earliest known tune about the sport. It was written in 1858. By J.R. Blodgett. He was a composer in Buffalo, New York, played for an amateur team in Buffalo. And the piece was written in homage to their counterparts in Rochester, New York, the other amateur team they were playing. And I thought this was absolutely fascinating, the first known song about baseball, but it was a gift from one baseball team to the other. And I was just thinking in my mind, my goodness, if the Yankees were to write a song about the Boston Red Sox and give it to them as a gift. I can't even imagine
that. It would be
obscene. Yeah, I wouldn't want to hear the lyrics, but...
It would be full of fingers, you know.
Something.
There's another baseball polka. Did I understand that from around the turn of the century?
There are a couple of them. Mm. In fact, the interesting item we discovered was that around the turn of the century, many teams had their own two-steps, their own polka, their own march. And as you get further into the 20th century, then the songs start to revolve around specific players. In fact, back in 1892, America's first pop hit was about a baseball player. Before Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, it was Slide Kelly Slide. It was about Mike King Kelly, who played for the Boston Beanstalkings. And he was the first celebrity in his own right. The whole notion of getting ballplayers' autographs originated with Mike King Kelly in Boston.
See, I'm only a marginal baseball fan. I used to be more of a baseball fan when I was in school, you know, grade school and so on. And so I don't go back all that far. But we got a song here from the guy I did follow. We'll get to that in a little bit. But here's that first baseball polka from 1858 by J.R. Blodgett here in Live and Local. There you go, the baseball polka. No words to that one, but we've got some words coming up to at least one of the famous players that Bob Thompson mentioned. We heard one of those player-derived songs, Jolton Joe DiMaggio by Alan Courtney, to start off the show. Bob Thompson's the conductor and founder and music director, I've forgotten. Music director, producer for the baseball music project, which is going to be at the Krannert Center in Urbana tomorrow night at 7:30. And it's not just going to be music either. There's the Champaign-Urbana Symphony featured on that, but also host and narrator, the great Hall of Famer Dave Winfield, is going to be narrating a couple of pieces. But also there's some tunes, or not some tunes, there's some events that precede all of this. The chance to meet some of the University of Illinois baseball team at 5:45 tomorrow night. There's a little talk by Professor Alan Nathan on the physics of baseball, which sounds kind of interesting. I saw there was a link on the Krannert Center website to that if you want a preview. I figured physics I haven't done since high school, so I was going to skip that article.
I'm going to meet him tomorrow morning because I want to know that story behind Mickey Mantle's home run, you know, which has studied.
There's physics behind that?
Yeah, the trajectory of the ball and how long it actually went.
I don't know the story. Tell me about the home run. He hit more than one.
I should know this, but it was that infamous very long home run, supposedly the longest home run ever hit. And Alan, I think, went into the physics of how long it actually was hit. So it's going to be an interesting lecture. I'm going to go to it.
I saw a headline, and I didn't, and then read the article that maybe he's going to talk about this too. That put into question about that the famous Babe Ruth thing, you know, where he pointed and said it's going over there.
Yeah.
Is that a myth of some kind?
It's a myth.
I thought that was documented.
It's a myth, like the Tooth Fairy and Santa Claus. I desperately want to believe in it.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, man, I'm crushed. I thought that was the real thing.
I thought so. I think it is, too. So.
Yeah, okay. You and I are going to continue to believe, and most of the rest of the world, so Professor Nathan can say what he will. If he's going to talk about that, yeah. We'll find out. So that's at 6:30 tomorrow. But then there's also University of Illinois, or the Illini Union Bookstore, is going to sell some appropriate books there if you want to buy those. There's some baseball-inspired design projects going on, some baseball mementos related to American Music Month, courtesy of the American Music Center and John Philip Sousa Archives on the University of Illinois campus, and complimentary popcorn. For that whole, I mean, you have to have popcorn at baseball, but is there beer?
Of course, the bar will be open as usual at Krannert Center at the Stage
5
bar.
Repeat that there, Bridge.
The bar will be open as always at Krannert Center, as it is during all
during all baseball events at Krannert Center.
During all baseball events and all evening events, actually, at the center, except for on Sundays. But the free popcorn is going to start at 5:30 and will be available in the lobby throughout the evening. But one thing you didn't mention, Kevin, is the exhibit that's been coordinated with Scott Schwartz, but there's some memorabilia loaned to us by the family of Dottie Schroeder, who was a woman who's from Sadorus and lived in Champaign most of her life and was a player in the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. Mm-hmm. And what a privilege to have her in our community for many years. She passed away in 1996, but to be able to share her legacy with our community is really a special facet of tomorrow evening.
And for folks that may not remember Dottie Schroeder, if you saw the movie League of Their Own, that was Gina Davis who played her character.
Played that character?
Yeah.
Didn't see that one.
Great film.
You have to
really
go and see it, Kevin. It's such an excellent film and really tells this otherwise untold story of the women's leagues and the extraordinary athleticism of the women who played in them.
We actually, before the show starts, if people get there early, we do a 45-minute pre-roll of archival video from the Hall of Fame. And one of the things we uncovered in working with the Hall of Fame, this is after Ken Burns did his documentary on baseball, we uncovered this old film footage of the women's leagues playing. So fans who show up early and come into the hall will see that.
Well, there's video during the whole show, right?
Yes. In fact, when I had this idea of putting together a concert, I got in touch with Jeff Idelson, the president of the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, And any of you listeners who have been to Cooperstown, you know it's off the beaten trail. It's about 4 hours on back roads from New York City to get there. So I said to Jeff, I'd love to bring Cooperstown to the concert hall, and I would love to take this rich history of imagery that's in the vault and archives of the Hall of Fame. So we have over 2,000 images that tell the story of the game that are all synchronized to music. So every square inch of music in the show has an image associated with it. And the other part of it was, and I was really, this was going over the top, I said to Jeff, do you think we could have a Hall of Famer narrate this? And Jeff thought about it and he said, you know, I think I've got the guy for you. Put me in touch with Dave Winfield. And Dave's been absolutely wonderful to work with. But for the audience out there, what you're going to see Friday night is the story of the game told in a very unique, personal way with all these images from the Hall of Fame, this wonderful music scored for orchestra, and you've got this 50-foot-wide screen above the stage, and you've got a living Hall of Famer talking about the game. And I know we've all seen these images of Satchel Paige and Babe Ruth and Stan Musial, all these great players, Ernie Banks. But when you see those images on a wide screen in a concert hall, it takes on a totally different significance.
You know, when I first heard about this baseball project, I mean, I knew I wanted to try to have you on the show, and I'm glad you were been definitely available for a long time. I mean, you were just about the first guy I booked for this season, courtesy of the Krannert Center. But I thought, you know, it sounds like it's kind of a fun idea. And then yesterday, I did get on the website, and there's a preview video, and I thought, oh my God, I'm so crushed that I actually can't go.
You
because
have
it gig. Looks fantastic. It looks fantastic. So if anybody wants to get, has any doubt at all that this might be something they might like to do with their time on Friday night, I'd encourage you to go to the website for the Baseball Music Project. Actually, you can just go to the Krannert Center website, and there's a link for it on the calendar page, the program page for that. And it really looks mesmerizing and a lot of fun. And, of course, one of the big reasons for the fun is the third word in there, which is the music. And I said there was one guy I used to follow. I mean, many, many people did, of course, who was the Say Hey Kid, Willie Mays.
Yeah.
I remember reading when I was in the Arrow Book Club in grade school, and that was one of the books I bought, was paperback of some biography of Willie Mays. And so there's this song called Say Hey.
Yeah.
What's the story behind that?
It's just about the great Willie Mays, and what an appropriate time of year to play this song. I mean, he had that famous, you know, catch in the 54 World Series. That was the last time the Giants won the World Series. Broke my dad's heart when they moved to San Francisco. He was a big New York Giants fan. We had a picture of Willie Mays up in our living room wall, if you can imagine. That's how big the Giants were in my family. And of course, you know, what an amazing year for the San Francisco Giants.
So I didn't watch any of the World Series this time around, but I'm assuming Willie Mays must have been there for at least part of it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
If not for the whole
McCovey
thing.
McCovey and, yeah, all those guys.
All those Willies.
Yeah.
Well, here's Say Hey, the Willie Mays song, composer Willard Robinson. And this comes from a disc called Baseball's Greatest Hits, Volume 1. How many volumes are there to that?
I think there's two.
Oh, just two. Well, then you guys need to record a bunch more. It sounds like you got enough material for it.
We could.
Bob Thompson with the Baseball Music Project. This is Live and Local.
Go get it, Willie.
Say, hey, Willie, go get it.
What do you mean, go get it? Man, that ball's way in left field.
I don't care what field it's in. Willie plays all field.
Every time we come to the game, you're talking about Willie plays all the field.
That's right.
Kid is great. That giant kid is great. Say, Willie, what you gonna say?
Say hey.
Say hey, the Willie Mays song, including the voice of Willie Mays in there. And composer was Willard Robinson. It seemed like there was a period in baseball where every other guy was named Willie.
Yeah, I think Willie McCovey. And
there seemed like a whole bunch of, who, there was a guy.
Willie Randolph, who was the manager.
There was a guy in the Phillies who was Willie something or another, at least if I remember. Actually went to a couple of Phillies games. I don't know what I'm talking about. I remember there was bunch of us in grade school, we would walk around the Guilford Hills Elementary School playground in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, with, you know, strolling around the playground with our arms around each other, chanting about Boog Powell and who was better, Boog Powell or Carl Yastrzemski. I don't even know if they played the same position.
Boog Powell was with the Baltimore Orioles.
Baltimore Orioles, that was the team I followed for a long time. Yeah. Paul Weaver, yeah. They're not doing anything now, are they?
Paid
any attention for years.
Yeah, they towards the end of the season they did pretty well. They started out slow, but they ended strong. You know,
I need to maybe I should start following them again. I used to know all the names of the players, long time ago. We're talking with Bob Thompson, who's conductor and music director for the Baseball Music Project, which is going to be at the Kranert Center tomorrow night at 7:30. Dave Winfield, host and narrator. What are the pieces that Dave Winfield's narrating?
Well, we made a special arrangement of Casey at the Bat for Dave, and it's absolutely hysterical.
The story,
yeah. The poem, and Dave does a version of that. So having a Hall of Famer on stage narrating that, of course, Dave had a slightly different career trajectory as Casey. Dave didn't strike out all that often with over 3,000 hits and all of that. But he's got such an amazing presence on stage and is just, he's a very funny guy. And the other piece he does is a work that was commissioned by the Rochester Philharmonic by a composer from Wisconsin, Fred Sturm. It's a 9-movement tour de force for orchestra called Forever Spring. And each movement consists of texts from some of the great literary writers about the sport, W.P. Kinsella, Shoeless Joe Jackson, and others, Bart Giamatti, Greenfields of the Mind. And it's a very 20-minute piece that opens the second half, but a very personal reflection on the game. And Dave does an amazing job with that. And then he's on stage throughout the concert talking about different aspects of the history of the game and his own personal experiences. And so
I think just for some of the videos that are going to be there would be worth the price of admission on its own. Because just seeing some of those in the preview clip on your website was a lot of fun.
If you haven't been to Cooperstown, this is as close as you're going to get in Champaign-Urbana. I mean, this is a...
So did you play baseball as a kid?
I did, and I had a perfect record. I struck out consistently for 2 years on the Sherman Park Little League. I played for an expansion team called the Mighty Owls. All the other bird names, all the teams were named after birds, Ravens, Wrens, Cardinals, Orioles. They were all taken, so we had a choice between the parakeets and the owls, and we all wore glasses at the time, so the owls seemed to fit us. But we had a perfect record. Never won a game in 2 years. And that was it for my baseball experience, really. I was a Mets fan for a while and then a Yankees fan. The real reason I came to put this project together was at the time, back in 2003, my dad was sick. He was coming down with Alzheimer's. One of the fondest memories of the game for me didn't come from the ballpark or the field. It came from my backyard. And I think a lot of us as kids growing up remember those days when we were out in the backyard with our dads playing catch. And I do that with my son. And it's a really beautiful moment. I think the two best things you can do with children are read them books and play catch with them, because it's at that moment where you don't need to talk. And you're both equal partners.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful thing. And my fondest memory of my dad was playing catch in the backyard.
I'm trying to remember if I did that with my dad. I mean, he's still around, but
it's not too late.
It could be soon. Maybe I better bring that up when I go home at Christmas time.
I've got my glove with me.
Well, you brought your. Is it just the two kids?
I just have one. Christopher is with me, and also Mara, who's a friend who's on tour with us.
Oh, I thought she was yours. Well, Christopher's been bobbing up and down outside our studio window here, very proudly showing
he's,
his...
He's the executive producer. He's 10 years old, celebrated his 10th birthday yesterday, but an avid baseball fan and the loudest Yankee fan you will find in the section of the stadium where we have our seats. So,
this is Christopher Thompson.
Christopher Thompson. He does arithmetic by players' names and numbers. What's A-Rod times Jeter minus Mickey Mantle?
Seriously?
Yeah.
He's dedicated.
Absolutely.
So he,
great guy.
Is he playing Little League?
He is. He's the starting pitcher on Sunday he has a championship game on Sunday. He plays for the Bisons.
So you got to get him back in time for that.
Got to get him back. We're flying back early Saturday because he's got that game against the Clippers.
And that's really important. He's hopping up down up and
very
down
excited.
Out there. Yeah.
Well, I love it.
I should have had him on the show here. I should have had him, executive producer and all. We should have him talking in here.
But I think for all the parents out there, you all know this, as exciting as it is to watch a World Series, there is nothing more tense and exciting than your son or daughter playing in a Little League game and they're at bat, and it's the bottom of the sixth and there's two outs.
And you're trying to restrain yourself from being the obnoxious dad in the stands.
I've gone through so many bottles of Pepto-Bismol.
More than you have to go through to conduct this show.
Exactly.
Which
this is
probably
is
just fine.
This is a labor of love. It's the most fun I get to do all year.
Well, it sounds like a blast. It's the Baseball Music Project. Bob Thompson is the conductor, music director for it, producer, and it happens tomorrow night. The concert starts at 7:30 at the Krannert Center in Urbana, but there's popcorn available starting at 5:30. You can meet some of the U of I baseball players starting at 5:45. There's a lecture on the physics of baseball. It's probably not a lecture, but just a fun talk. 6:30, and lots of other things going on. Check out the Krannert Center website, krannertcenter.com, and go hear the concert. It sounds like a whole lot of fun to me. And Bob, why don't you set up this last song? We're going to do, what are we going to do here? Let's Keep the Dodgers in Brooklyn. Sort of thinking of your dad. And he hated the idea of the Giants going to San Francisco.
And that came a year later. I think it was, 58? Walter O'Malley announced that the Dodgers were moving to Los Angeles. And conversation in Brooklyn stopped that day. So this is baseball's one and only protest song in homage to Bob Dylan. This is Phil Foster singing Let's Keep the Dodgers in Brooklyn.
Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Sounds like a great show. You're listening to Live and Local.
Say, did you hear the news about what's happening in Brooklyn? We really got the blues about what's happening in Brooklyn. It ain't official yet. We hope officially.
Keep the Dodgers in Brooklyn, USA.
We really love them. Keep the Dodgers in Brooklyn, O'Malley.
Do me one favor. Mind your own business and stay home. Don't leave town.
Let's Keep the Dodgers in Brooklyn. Let's see. Who wrote that song? I've got it written down here somewhere. Maybe you know, but in any event, it's one of the songs that's going to be featured in the Baseball Music Project at the Krannert Center. Tomorrow night at 7:30. Here we go. Composer Sewell Denoff. I'll bet you didn't know that, and neither did I. You're listening to Live and Local on FM 90.9. Our programs are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, welcoming baseball legend Dave Winfield and the Champaign-Urbana Symphony Orchestra as they present the Baseball Music Project tomorrow, Friday, November 12th at 7:30 p.m. For more information, visit krannertcenter.com. Also at the Krannert Center starting tonight is Verdi's opera Rigoletto from the University of Illinois Opera Program. There's a performance tonight, tomorrow, and Saturday at 7:30 and a Sunday matinee at 3 o'clock in the Tryon Festival Theater. The conductor and music director for the opera program is Eduardo Diaz-Munoz, and the stage director comes from the U of I's theater department is Henson Keyes. And Henson is on the show with us right now. Thanks very much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
So you got a tough act to follow with this baseball theme.
Really, I was out in the lobby listening to it and waxing nostalgic about my own Pony League days in Lincoln, Illinois.
Yeah, were you a baseball player?
I was. I was crazy. I was a relief pitcher and a first baseman.
And how did you do?
I actually made the All-Star team when I was 10 years old. So
you did better than Mr. Baseball Bob Thompson.
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't get to mention my big claim to fame was the first Little League team I played on. I think we might have been called the Orioles. Mm. And for some reason, the coach decided to have me pitch, which I'd never done before. And somebody hit a line, you know, somebody hit a line drive straight at my head. And I just stuck my glove up and...
You got it?
I got it.
Wow.
Hurt like hell, but, you know, I got... And then I don't know what happened after that. I'm sure we lost the game, and they never let me pitch again. But
my lifetime record as a pitcher was 0-2.
Well, it
not quite as impressive as my first baseman days.
Yeah. It could have been 0-10,
that's
so
true.
Not too bad. And besides, if you were a relief pitcher, then you could really blame it on the other guy.
Yeah, and I did.
Yeah. As well you should have. Well, let's talk about Rigoletto.
Yeah.
You know, I don't remember the story of Rigoletto, so why don't you let us know?
Well, it's the story of a the court of the Duke of Mantua, and he has a court jester, a hunchbacked court jester named Rigoletto, who is very cruel and torments the courtiers, and they decide to get revenge on him because he secretly has a daughter who he keeps very sheltered because he wants her to stay out of the sort of amoral life of the court. And he's the courtiers get wind of her and think that she's actually his mistress, and so they steal her away and give her to the Duke, who has his way with her, so to speak. And in the end, Rigoletto is cursed by another father, and the curse is fulfilled as he tragically loses his own daughter due to his own vengeful actions. So it's not exactly a light piece of fluff, this opera. But it's one of Verdi's most exciting scores. There's very, very familiar tunes in it, and we have a terrific cast of singers. And I've got a particular concept for this production that I think will make it more accessible.
And what is that concept?
Well, when I've seen Rigoletto in New York and at the Met, I always feel slightly distanced by it because it's usually set in 1500 with all the huge Renaissance costumes and trappings. And it always feels to me like I'm watching a fairy tale that could only happen long ago and far away. And so Diaz-Munoz and I worked up the notion that we're setting this in a more timeless way. The major theme of this opera is what happens to innocence in a world gone crazy and amoral. And we thought the best way that we might do this is to set it immediately following some huge catastrophe that's destroyed the physical world. Earthquake, war, flood. We've really modeled it after earthquake, the set is. So the society is actually rebuilding itself physically and morally. And unfortunately, it's being led by the Duke, who is the height of amorality. And he's brought along all of his henchmen, who are the courtiers. And it's allowed us to, I think, make it much more accessible to a modern audience, and also to make the point that the themes of this opera are, in fact, timeless and apply just as much today as they would have. And I think this has also allowed us to make a wide range of, since we're not setting it in a specific time period, we've got costumes that range from full period costumes all the way down to what you would see today on the street. So I think it's going to be a very interesting production. We had a invited dress last night with a number of students from the honors program who always come to our dress rehearsals. And I got email this morning that they had really liked it and felt that it was so much more accessible to them in this version. And for us, I think it makes it that much more exciting that we're not just throwing up pretty costumes and doing it in the traditional manner.
And you don't have to change the characters or change the dialogue or anything like that in order to make it fit?
We haven't changed a word of the libretto. And that's the important thing to me, is that the Verdi's intentions are fulfilled in this. I don't like opera where you have a concept that's sort of stuck on something, whether it relates to the actual story or not. And I think with this concept, we haven't had to change anything. And it seems to me that it fits the opera like a glove. And I think it's going to be that much more exciting, I think.
Yeah, some of the times that directors will take things out of the originally intended time, and it really feels artificial and kind of forced, and So I'm glad that the initial reception is, was very positive from last night.
Yeah, we've worked very hard to do the opposite of what you're just talking about, because I don't think any of us likes concept opera that's without a particular purpose, and that is that has moments in it which are contrary to the music or contrary to the story that they have to somehow adjust to it. But we're not going to be doing that.
You said that, in telling the story, that it's not exactly the most, certainly not the most happy ending in the world, and yet the most famous aria from it is quite, jaunty and so on.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a lot of jaunty music in it. Much of it sort of the opposite of what's going on stage. In other words, the La Donna Mobile, which everybody in the world knows, and which, by the way, somebody in the audience was singing along with last night. I think it's very, very popular. And even in context, though, it's about how the Duke doesn't value women and how he thinks they're fairly silly. And
what does that text mean, La Donna Mobile?
It means basically women are fickle. They go where the wind blows. You know, one is no different from the other, and you have to be careful around them. So he's sort of spouting his philosophy.
In other words, you got to be really careful around the Duke.
Oh, yeah.
If you're a woman.
Oh, yeah.
And probably anybody else for that matter. Well, it's Roberto Alagna here as the Duke in La Donna e Mobile, the most famous bit from Giuseppe Verdi's Rigoletto, which is going up tonight at the Krannert Center in the University of Illinois Opera Program production. And our guest is Henson Keyes, stage director for that production. It opens at 7:30. Tonight. You're listening to Live and Local. And that's the end of that excerpt. We're playing from a highlights disc with Riccardo Muti leading the orchestra of La Scala, Roberto Alagna as the Duke of Mantua from Verdi's Rigoletto, which is at the University of Illinois this week, tonight, tomorrow, and Saturday at 7:30, and Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock. Eduardo Diaz Munoz conducts, and Henson Keyes is the stage director for that. Henson, how is directing an opera different from directing a play, if it's different?
Oh, it is different. I get asked that a lot because I do so much Shakespeare directing also. But there's something about being surrounded by the music that excites me tremendously. And the major difference really is that in blocking the setting up the movement for the opera, there's only so much the singers can do physically and manage to sing at the same time. And one also has to make sure that they're at least facing partially out so that the voice will carry out to the audience and not go back into the set. And there's really a different style. Operatic acting is by necessity a bit melodramatic. But it still requires an enormous commitment from the performer and a sense of dramatic truth, which is, I think, even more difficult than it is in acting, because the singer has to be technically proficient in the actual production of the sound and at the same time has got to try to act. For instance, frequently in opera, people are requested to cry while singing, which is actually impossible to do. So you have to figure out a way to be realistically emotional without allowing it to affect the breathing and the vocal production.
I'm just remembering, well, any number of tenors in La Boheme, for example, the end of La Boheme, mm-hmm. when Mimi dies in the arms of Rodolfo, and I'm thinking of Luciano Pavarotti, and of course the crying always sounds like only an opera singer can cry that way,
exactly.
You know.
But I think you'll find in Rigoletto that it's always been my philosophy about opera that the story has to be told so that an audience can buy into it. So there are no people who are, shall we say, of an inappropriate size for the characters. And the voices are wonderful. They're young and exciting singers. And also, I'm allowed as a director, thankfully, to try to make the story as realistic as I can and to make movement choices that will be realistic and will help the singers rather than give them a problem.
How is there a particular challenge working with singers who are singers first and actors second, as opposed to folks in your theater program who are actors first?
Well, I think that actually is less true these days than it was maybe 10, 20 years ago, because the opera world, professional opera world, has become so much more size and temperament conscious in terms of the casting choices that you can't just send out a 400-pound Juliet to the middle of the stage to wave her arms and sing. That just doesn't work anymore. So I think that the singers are now realizing, even in school, that they have to learn to act if they're going to get work in the way the modern opera world is.
And are there mechanisms in place in the opera program now to do that?
They have a class called Opera Studio where they work on scenes and particularly the acting of them rather than necessarily the singing of them.
And do they have folks from the theater department come in and work, or just within the opera program?
It's within the opera program, although Maestro Díaz-Muñoz has been really emphasizing using directors from the theater department because he likes that sense of theatricality that we can bring to it, and a little bit less emphasis on the singing and more on the acting.
Speaking of singing, let's have a little bit more of it from Rigoletto. You picked another aria here from the title character. Mm-hmm. You want to set this up for us?
Sure. This is one of the greatest arias ever written. And Rigoletto, whose daughter has been stolen away by the courtiers, enters in an absolute fury in Act Two. And this aria is called Cortigiani Vil Razza Danata, which means courtiers, you vile race of vile damned race. And he goes from fury in the beginning of the aria into sadness in the middle of it, and finishes by begging for their pity. It's an amazing piece of work.
In the role of Rigoletto, we have Renato Brusone, and this is still with La Scala and conductor Riccardo Muti from Verdi's Rigoletto on Live and Local. There we heard some tears at the end, you know.
Uh-huh.
But he, you know, right in the middle of singing the big note, Renato Brusone as the title character of Rigoletto from Verdi's opera here on Live and Local, Riccardo Muti conducting. And you can see the complete opera four times this week if you want. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday night at 7:30 and Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock at the Kranert Center in Urbana, the production of the University of Illinois opera program, which is directed by, the program is not directed, but this opera is directed by Henson Keyes, who is my guest on this portion of Live and Local. And as we were listening to that, you were just telling me that, Henson, they call you in to direct when there's storm and drang and angst and death.
It's true. It really is true. I get called in mainly for the Verdi and the Puccini because there's lots of pain and suffering and death.
Yeah, so what appeals to you about that in opera?
I actually think, I really think music serves those kind of emotions better than comedy. I think comic operas for me tend to be amusing for about an hour, and then I've sort of done with it.
And you've had it. That's enough of that.
But I think the one thing about why I'd really like people to come and see this Rigoletto is that I think it's going to be really exciting, and I think that the cast is terrific, and you won't be disappointed.
Two different casts, we should say.
Two different casts, one Thursday and Saturday, and the other Friday and Sunday afternoon.
Well, thanks very much for joining us, Henson Keyes.
Great to be here.
On Live and Local. Go see Rigoletto. Here's some other things you can go out and see, for that matter. If you're in around Bloomington, you can go see Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro at Illinois Wesleyan University at Westbrook Auditorium. That's at 8 o'clock through Sunday. I imagine the Sunday is a matinee. The Becca Young Jazz Sound is at Southside Pub tonight at 8 o'clock in Springfield. The musical Altar Boys is at the Hoagland Center for the Arts in Springfield through this week, starting tonight at 8 o'clock. At Eastern Illinois University in Charleston, the Wind Symphony there is playing A Call to Duty, a Veterans Day tribute. That's in the down the Fine Arts Center tonight at 7:30. The Catherine Randolph Theater is the location for a play called Inherit the Wind in Danville. That's tomorrow at 8 o'clock, and I think through the weekend as well. The musical The Drowsy Chaperone is at the Kirkland Fine Arts Center at Millikan University in Decatur tomorrow and Saturday night at 7:30. And singer-songwriter Ellis Paul is at the Hoagland Center for the Arts along with Ashley Riley tomorrow night at 8 o'clock, and he's going to be on Live and Local on tomorrow's show from noon to 1. And along with more on that show as well. This is Live and Local. I'll be back with you again for tomorrow. I'm Kevin Kelly. Our program today comes in part with support from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines for the series collected or the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held in the Bronze Tasting Room on Saturdays from noon to 4. This Saturday's tasting features Lisa Odom of Maverick Wine Company pouring a selection of wines from around the world. More information is at thecorkscrew.com. This is Illinois Public Media, WYLFM and HD1 and HD2 Urbana, with translators W266 AF Urbana and W293 AF Danville. WYL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. It's 73 degrees at 101.